This is a very, very important and meaningful message. It is an important message because it can bring you great benefit. And in my view, this message that Jesus gave to his disciples is a meaningful message because it can bring into your life increased control during those times when you need control the most. Jesus gave this message to his disciples, a message of suffering and what to do when you suffer. And of course, he gave it to them during their time and in their culture. If you clearly understand the message, it can bring you great benefit. It can be very helpful. And I think, in order to clearly understand this message, it might be good if we begin with our time and our culture. America is suffering. All I have to say is San Bernardino, California, or the cities of Texas in the wake of Hurricane Harvey, or Orlando, Florida, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, North Korea. America is suffering greatly. And of course, we all know America has suffered in the past. Americans suffered through the Civil War, World War I, the Great Dust Bowl, the Great Depression, World War II. You see, suffering is an inevitable and an inexorable part of the human condition. America will probably suffer in the future. Jesus suffered, Mary suffered, Joseph suffered. You heard this evening the lamentations and tribulations of Jeremiah in his suffering and his agony. Suffering is a part of the human condition. Now, personally, I don't think it should be. I think when God decided to allow suffering, that was a mistake. And someday if I get to talk to him, I'm going to straighten him out on that. But in the meantime, suffering exists. It is real. It can go very deep. It can be profoundly painful. You might be suffering. And even if you're not, you probably have in the past. And you may suffer at some time in the future. Jesus talked to his disciples and told them about suffering. He talked about suffering, specifically his suffering and suffering in general. The first thing he said to the disciples, when Peter said, "No, Lord, you mustn't suffer," he said, "Get thee behind me, Satan. You're thinking like a human. You're not thinking like God." Calling Peter Satan? What he was saying was, "Don't tempt me, Peter. Don't tempt me to think like a human being." So that brings to mind, when human beings suffer, how do they normally respond to it? My observations over the years, when people suffer, they either respond with anger or fear or sorrow. If they respond with anger, or any combination of the three, if they respond with anger, they yell at each other, they shout at each other, they insist on their position, they put the other person down, or worse yet, their anger grows into violence. Let's throw a brick through a plate glass window downtown because we don't like what's going on. Or let's shoot a policeman, or let's shoot our antagonists. When humans respond to their suffering with anger, the suffering doesn't dissipate, and the anger intensifies the suffering and expands it into the lives of others. Or maybe they will respond to their suffering with fear, trepidation, worry. And then what they do is they play a scenario in their minds over and over again about what now may happen as a result of what I'm suffering. And every scenario they think about is worse and more terrifying than the previous one. And so they expand the suffering and they intensify it because they now not only have to deal with the burden of whatever it is they're suffering from, they got to deal with the burden of their fear. And then, of course, there's the human response of sorrow. People who are suffering quite often get sad. despondent, depressed, in despair. Once again, they've intensified the suffering and they spread it into the lives of their friends, their families, their loved ones. Jesus said this specifically relative to suffering. He said, "Follow me." Now, let's be clear about that. When Jesus says, "Follow me," he doesn't mean literally he expects you to go through a literal crucifixion as he was about to. When Jesus ever says, "Follow me," what he means is follow my example, follow my role modeling. How did he respond to his suffering? How did he respond to his antagonists? Well, the first thing he did was he forgave them. The second response he had was he asked God the Father to forgive them, saying, "They know not what they do." He responded to his antagonists with love, with compassion, and with forgiveness. That did not relieve his suffering. It diffused it. He did not respond to his suffering with fear. He had steely confidence and courage. He did not respond to his suffering with sorrow and despair, wringing his hands. He was calm and resolute. Follow me. His response to suffering diffused the effect of the suffering. It did not intensify it or expand it. But the question is, Deacon, that's really nice, but how am I supposed to do that? I'm not God, and he was. Yes, Jesus was fully God. But wasn't he also fully human? How was he able to respond as he did as a human being? It's pretty simple, really. Jesus had a rock-like foundational faith that God the Father was taking care of him. A rock-like foundational faith that God the Father was caring for him. In your quiet and contemplative moments, think back on your life, not now, for the next 2 or 3 seconds, sometime when you get alone by yourself, quiet contemplation, and you will see that God has always taken care of you, because there are too many coincidences for them to be coincidences. God has always taken care of you, and he will continue to do so in the future. With that will come rock-like foundational faith that no matter what's going on in your life, there is a way out and you will get through. Let me share a poem with you, one of my favorites. You've all heard it before. As soon as I start, you'll recognize it. Maybe you studied it at the university. But the reason I want you to hear it again is that it sums up succinctly, simply, and I think powerfully, why it is abundantly true that when you are suffering, there is a way out and you will get through. Here's how it goes. It was battered and scarred, and the auctioneer hardly thought it worth his while to waste much time on the old violin, but he held it up with a smile. "What am I bidding, good folks?" said he. "Who'll start the bidding for me? A dollar, who'll make it two? Make it two, make it three, $3 once, $3 twice, going and gone." But no. Far back in the room, a gray-haired man came forward and picked up the bow. And wiping the dust off that old violin and tightening up its loose strings, he played a melody pure and as sweet as a caroling angel sings. And when the music stopped, the auctioneer said with a voice that was quiet and low, "What am I bid for this old violin?" And he held it up with the bow. $1,000, and who'll make it two? $2,000, and who'll make it three? $3,000 once, $3,000 twice, going and gone, said he. And the crowd cheered. But some of them cried, "We don't quite understand. What changed its worth?" Swift came the reply, "It was the touch of a master's hand." Now here's the close. And many a man with life out of tune, battered and scarred with sin, is auctioned cheap to the thoughtless crowd, much like the old violin. a mess of pottage, a glass of wine, a game, and he travels on. He's going once, he's going twice, he's going and almost gone. But then the master comes, and the foolish crowd never can quite understand the worth of a soul or the change that is wrought by the touch of the master's hand. No matter what you're going through, there is a way out, and you will get through, because you have been touched by the master's hand.